We've been studying this book of John, the Gospel of John, for about a year now on these Sunday mornings. And we come to what is by many commentators considered John's proper conclusion in chapter 20 and verses 30 and 31. Yes, there's still another chapter to go, and we'll consider that next week. It's rightly, I think, looked at as a kind of an epilogue to the rest of the book. In this conclusion, though, John states what his purpose has been. He tells us that Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. John is answering a question. And the question is, who is the Messiah? That is the emphasis in the original Greek. In the translation that I have, we might think that the question is, who is Jesus? But the actual emphasis lies on who is the Messiah. This, after all, is an important question for any Jew. And it was to Jews predominantly that John was writing, together with proselytes from the Gentiles, those who had converted to Judaism, and those who, like the man that we read of in the book of Acts, Cornelius, was a God-fearer, not a complete proselyte. He hadn't completely adopted Jewish practices. He wasn't a circumcised man and was therefore not properly considered part of the covenant community of Israel. No, he would have to go the whole hog in order to do that. But he was a God-fearing man. He worshipped the God of the Jews. He had a high regard for the Jewish nation. These were the people that John addressed as his original audience. His original readers were those who were waiting for, longing for, anticipating with great expectation the coming of the Messiah, the promised deliverer. And the question then on their minds is, who is he? Who is the Messiah? Who is the promised deliverer? And John answers, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus is the Messiah. I want you to believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. He is the promised deliverer. He is the one who removes oppression. He is the one who brings people fully and finally out of their captivity in order to worship God. This is the call of God. This is what he said to Pharaoh in Egypt. Let my people go so that they may serve me. So that they may worship me. And the reality is that despite the fact that Pharaoh had let the people go, though somewhat reluctantly, and with second thoughts after it had happened, the people had never fully and finally been released from their captivity. The people had never fully and finally been able to properly worship God. Oh yes, they went to Mount Sinai and received their inauguration as a nation. They received laws. They received rituals that they were to follow in order to approach God and to worship God. And all of that was a blessing from God to this one nation that he had singled out when he called Abram out of Ur of the Chaldees. They had all of that, but they didn't have freedom. They couldn't serve God. After the giving of the law at Mount Sinai, a few months later they reached the edge of the promised land, and as we saw in the reading from the book of Numbers, on the brink of entering into the promised land, a land flowing with milk and honey, a land of prosperity and promise, they rebelled against the Lord, and that was a continual mark of their existence as a nation. One rebellion against God after another. You can hardly call that service of God, can you? You can hardly call that proper and appropriate worship of the living God who had called them out of Egypt to do that thing. You see, their hearts were still in chains, even though their bodies may be free. And so it was that the prophets of old promised a greater deliverer than even Moses had been, though he led the people out of their captivity in Egypt. The prophets promised a better priest than even Aaron had been, even though he led the people of Israel in worship of the living God through the sacrificial system that God had enacted. You see, all through the Old Testament, the Israelites have promised something better, something greater, something that will at last bring them complete freedom to worship God. But the remarkable thing is that throughout the Old Testament, in all these prophecies that are given to Israel, there is a still greater promise. That the full and final freedom that will be given to the people of God will encompass more than the descendants of Abraham in the flesh. That all nations would be drawn to worship the living God and to serve him. This is the great promise. Now, who is this deliverer? Who is going to accomplish what Moses couldn't accomplish and what Aaron couldn't accomplish? Who is the one who will fully and finally redeem and free the people of God from their shackles that prevent them from serving God properly and worshipping fully? And John says, it's Jesus. It's Jesus. A man from despised Nazareth, as one hymn writer puts it. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? One of the early disciples asked before he encountered Jesus personally. What an unpromising beginning. And still more than that, you see, Jesus not only came from an insignificant town in Judea, a despised place, but his parentage was quite questionable. Indeed, repeatedly through this Gospel of John, we hear from the lips of the enemies of Jesus, the scribes and the Pharisees, the elders of the Jews, barbed comments. We know who our father is, we don't know who yours is. You're a bastard child. the illegitimate son, the fruit of fornication. Not a very promising beginning for someone who is to be embraced by the Jewish nation and become their deliverer. But John asserts, nevertheless, Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus is the Christ. Jesus is the one that you are waiting for. What an astounding claim. And what's more, this itinerant teacher who walked the streets of Jerusalem and the lanes of Galilee seemed to be a rather weak person, really. He had lots of nice things to say, certainly, and his teaching came with a kind of authority that bemused the leaders of Israel. But nevertheless, the Messiah who was to come was to be a royal figure, not a man from poverty. He was to be a mighty warrior who would raise up an army to destroy any power that stood in his way and establish Israel as a superpower in the world before whom all the other nations of the world would bow. The closest Jesus ever got to a kingly figure was riding on the colt of a donkey. No crown, no royal retinue. Children praising him, yes, but the leaders of Israel denying him. "Tell them to be quiet," they said to him. No, you see, the Jews were not expecting someone like Jesus. But John is adamant. Jesus is the Christ. And it is by believing this fact that you will have life. It is by believing in Jesus that you will have freedom. It is by following Jesus that you will be led out of your captivity and enabled to serve God, to worship God as he desires. And so it is that throughout this book, John has sought to present Jesus in his proper and rightful place as the Messiah. In order to do that, he has had to reshape the thinking, the expectations of his readers. He's had to take them back to the Old Testament and demonstrate how Jesus is the fulfillment of the promises, of the types and shadows, the symbols that were presented there. He has to reconfigure in their minds the misplaced and misunderstood applications of the promises of the Old Testament. And he's done so by means of a number of signs. He has chosen a very few out of an abundance of signs. He tells us himself, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. Elsewhere, another writer supposes that the whole world couldn't contain the written accounts of everything that Jesus did. thousands upon thousands of people healed. Healings that are just passed over without any description. We're just told that multitude thronged around bringing their sick to Jesus and he healed them. Simple comments like that. But John has picked out a number of signs, a number of miracles that he then uses in order to present to his readers Jesus as the Messiah. He numbers some of the initial signs. The very first sign that he did, as you may recall, was changing of water into wine. A sign which was intended to demonstrate the glory of Jesus as the Creator. He is able to make the best wine out of a common water drawn out of a well. But there's also more significance in that because we have a newness there that is replacing the old. There's a turning point taking place that is significant for his Jewish readers. They need to understand that what is happening in the life of Jesus, in his coming into this world, in the work that he will accomplish in his life, is out of all proportion to anything that they have in their minds concerning the deliverer. It will be astounding what he will do. And he will do it in such an improbable way. Jesus healed an official's son with a word without even being present. He demonstrated the need that there was to believe in him, to believe the works that he did, but more than that, to believe the word that he spoke. You see, Jesus was to speak with an authority that would cause those who sought to arrest him to turn back empty-handed. He spoke with a kind of authority that caused those who on the night when he was finally arrested to first fall down. There was something different about this man. His words conveyed a power and authority that was unlike anything that anyone had ever heard before. And indeed, it was seen in other signs, like the stilling, the calming of the waters. He healed a man at the pool of Siloam. And in the midst of the discussion that ensues following that miracle recorded in the fifth chapter of this gospel, he demonstrates his unity with the Father. There is a special, a unique relationship between this man from Nazareth than there has ever been in any of the history of Israel between God and any other man. He always does the will of the Father. He only speaks what the Father instructs him to speak, and he only does what the Father instructs him to do. His will and the will of the Father is one. And his work and the work of the Father is one since time began. He performs an incredible miracle of feeding 5,000 men. In addition to them, women and children as well. At least 10,000. Possibly as many as 25,000, some commentators argue, were fed with 5 loaves, 5 small cakes and 2 fish. Lunch for a little boy. Because Jesus is the bread of life. He is the one who gives life, nourishes life, sustains life. And of course, that is most clearly demonstrated in one of the last sign miracles that he performs, the raising of Lazarus, his beloved friend, from the dead, after his body had already begun to stink in the heat of the Galilean day. This is what Jesus came to do. He came to bring life. And all these signs, John says, all these signs are given so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah. All of them, as we have seen, we don't have time, obviously, to cover all the same ground again this morning. Go back, listen to the recordings if you need to. All these signs demonstrate different aspects of Jesus' fulfillment of the promises of the Old Testament and the expectations that are given there. But will the people see? Will they see? You see, Jesus had healed a man born blind. He gave him sight, far more significant than the physical sight that he was given, was an understanding that the man who had healed him was someone sent from God to do God's work. But we observed in our study there in chapter 9 that those who thought they could see were in reality blind. They questioned Jesus. They doubted Jesus. They ridiculed his claims, sought to undermine his work, and eventually would put him to death. They thought they could see. They thought they understood the Old Testament. They thought their expectations were right and that this man was an imposter. But in reality, they were blind. They could not see. And Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, so that you may see that Jesus is the Christ. Because John has also recounted the greatest sign of all, the sign of Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. The sign that Thomas saw. "Here I stand, Thomas," Jesus says. "Come here. You know I was killed on that cross. Here are the marks in my hands. Here's the hole that the spear left in my side. Now come, Thomas, come, see. Put your finger here, see my hands. Put your hand and place it in my side. Don't disbelieve, but believe." And Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." This is the greatest sign of all. That Jesus, in his death on the cross, brought salvation to his people. Now, of course, the Jews can't comprehend this. The death on the cross of their enemies who are ruling over them. How can this be the means of freeing people from their slavery so that they can serve and worship God? How can this do it? But you see, this is the greatest fulfillment of any of the prophecies of the Old Testament. This is the fulfillment of all the sacrificial symbols of substitutionary atonement, where one who was without spot and blemish gave his life in the place of those who were marred and marked by sin, so thoroughly stained that it could never be cleansed away with any ritual washing. But Jesus came, and with his perfect life, without spot and blemish, he offered himself as a sacrifice for the sins of his people. And with his blood, he washes away those marks of sin that run so deep in our lives that nothing but the blood of the incarnate Son of God could purge them away. Jesus is the substitute who dies in the place of his people, who placates the wrath of God as he bears it himself. And he rises the third day, proving the acceptability of his sacrifice, and Thomas sees it. Thomas touches the marks that prove it, and he believes. And these things are written so that you may believe. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Not seen the changing of the water into wine. Not seen the healing of the official's son with a word. Not seen the raising of the man beside the pool of Siloam to full health and vitality. Who have not seen the feeding of 5,000 plus people beside the Sea of Galilee. Those who have not seen the healing of a man born blind. Or the raising of Lazarus to the dead. Who have not seen the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth. And his resurrection from the dead. These things are given to us so that we who have not seen may nevertheless believe. This is a true testimony, the writer says. He who saw it has borne witness. He knows that he is telling the truth, that you also may believe. Because as I've already intimated, Jesus came to release not just the Jews from their ongoing chains that inhibited their service of God and worship of him. It wasn't just to finish off what Moses had started when he led the people of Israel out of Egypt. No, Jesus came into the world to finish off what Adam started when he rebelled against God in the Garden of Eden and plunged the whole of humanity under slavery to sin, to selfishness, to the lusts of the flesh and of the eye and the pride of life, to our selfish living for our own pleasure and our own comfort. Jesus came into this world in order to reverse that which Adam had done. He came to bring freedom to the world, to everyone who would believe. Yes, he in a very special way came to the children of Israel. He came to his own people, but his own people did not receive him, but to as many as believe in his name. He gave the right to be children of God. A right that extends beyond the promises to Israel as a nation and properly interprets then those promises that were given to Abraham and his descendants. It is a promise that is so wonderfully illustrated for us in the conversion of Cornelius and the Gentiles gathered in his house when Peter went there and proclaimed the signs that he had seen. The life and death and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth as the Messiah. A Messiah not for Jews only, but to everyone who would believe in his name. These things are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name, a fullness of life that enables you to worship God and serve God, free from the shackles of sin. The question is, do you believe? There are two kinds of people in this world. The seeing and the blind. What kind of person are you? When you take up this book and you read it, do you see great stories that entertain children before they go to bed? They're there. They're wonderful. But is that all you see? Do you see great moral instruction that if only the nations of the world would take it on board and live by it, this world would be a completely different place? Is that what you see? It's there. And it's true. But is that all you see? Because you see, the stories are wonderful and great in and of themselves, but they're more wonderful and greater when you understand their significance. And the moral precepts that are presented here would transform this world if only mankind would live by them. But you see, mankind can't live by them. Mankind is shackled by sin. And Jesus came to free us so that the precepts that are presented in this book can be obeyed, can be lived by, and so that the stories can be lived out in their great and grand fulfillment. What do you see when you see Jesus? A good man, a great teacher, or a glorious Saviour? These things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing in him you may have life.